You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
This is episode 198 of the Healthy Critters Radio on the Horse Radio Network. Healthy Critters Radio is brought to you by BioStar US. Find them online at BioStarUS.com.
On today's show, we have tips for maintaining habitat for wild birds and songbirds. Critter of the show is the Cardigan Welsh Corgi. In Critter Nutrition, we focus on Boulardii yeast for dogs. And in Coffee Clatch, our favorite fly control. Join us. Hi, I'm Tigger.
And I'm Patty.
And I'm Coach Jen. Welcome back to Healthy Critters, where we talk about all things healthy and all things critters. You know, actually, we do talk a lot about things that aren't so healthy.
True.
And why we continue to do them despite the fact that we know we shouldn't. For example, today I ate 4 Rice Krispies treats.
Holy cow.
4. Now, they were small, but I ate 4 of them.
I don't like them.
No? How about you, Patty? Do you like Rice Krispies treats? Oh, we lost Patty. She'll be back. That's okay. And for the uninitiated, a Rice Krispies treat is Rice Krispies cereal, and you take a big bag of marshmallows, and you melt them with an enormous quantity of butter, and then you stir in the Rice Krispies and then let them cool, and they are delicious and wonderful.
That's a thought.
There's a thought. See, that was just a random thought. That's what happens here on Healthy Critters Radio when we all come in and we're all just a little bit brain fried on a, I don't even know what day of the week it is here.
Wednesday.
We're all a little bit brain fried on a Wednesday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're only halfway through the rake week and we're already done in. Patty, just for reference, how many horses did you ride today?
Oh, gee whiz. In total, between riding and teaching, did 12.
There we go. And how many million clients did you assist today, Tigger?
6.
There we go. I didn't do nearly that much and my brain's fried already. So there we go. We're all working hard. And I'm sure everybody else is working hard too. And on Wednesday, when you're feeling a little bit brain dead, the best thing to do is to listen in to the most recent episode of Healthy Critters. Because... We all try real
and
hard
get
to feel
really
better.
Brain dead
and get really brain dead. It's just a stream of consciousness kind of a show. And what is our roundtable today? Because that's what we always do next.
World Cup.
Oh, what's World Cup?
I watched the last 5 rides this morning.
Now tell everybody what World Cup is, because there's a lot of different. You know, it could be something hockey for all we know.
The World Cup dressage in Saudi Arabia.
Ooh.
What's sort of interesting, and also the show jumping. So we've got both jumping and dressage in Saudi Arabia. One of show jumping's online sort of news websites, it's called World of Show Jumping. Mm-hmm. They are not covering the World Cup for jumping. Because of Saudi Arabia's repression of women and human rights. So I thought that was a very courageous move, actually.
Mm. Yeah.
They, obviously disagree with the FEI that it shouldn't have taken place there. Mm-hmm. I don't have that particular feeling one way or another. But I thought it was a very interesting journalistic stance because all 4 of their reporters are women.
Yeah.
So you cannot go to World of Show Jumping and find out anything about the World Cup.
Nothing there.
For the show jumpers.
No.
But you can watch the dressage on Clip My Horse.
And?
Oh, okay.
Tell us about your experience viewing those rides?
Well, I saw the last 5, including Lottie Fry. and Everdale, and Isabel. Isabel had a shockingly full of mistakes ride.
Really?
And you could tell afterwards, man, she was pissed. Oh, God. He couldn't get the two Tempes. He kept wanting to do one Tempes, and he was not the only horse that kind of fell out of canter. I think he fell out of it right before the one Tempes. And that happened to another horse that, you know, there's that place where they have to make a trot transition in the Grand Prix test, right? After the canter work is done. And they get to that, the rider is turning to go on the diagonal. The horse goes, no, I think I'm supposed to trot here.
Yeah.
And it, that the twos was extremely costly. I mean, I think she got twos.
Ooh, ow.
And a three. Yeah, because he never really did any. I mean, maybe he did two.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the most interesting part to me, so she's standing in fourth. Now, mind you, if it was any of us mere mortals and on our horse did that, we would be way lower than fourth.
she got some twos, but she got a lot of eights as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Was her expression coming out of the arena? I mean, oh, she was, I don't think she was mad at the horse, but I think she was either mad at herself or mad at the situation, but. Ooh.
Aw.
Holy cow.
That's a shame. Well, the flaming hoops, financially, emotionally, physically.
Oh, and they of course,
that they
the
have
camera.
To do to get to a World Cup, regardless
this
of where
this was her 25th World Cup.
Wow.
That's incredible.
That's crazy. Now,
yeah.
Patty, to fill me in, because I'm pretty clueless when it comes to how these things get together. For World Cup, is that a team that is chosen by a selection committee, or is that something you simply qualify for?
We have to qualify for it.
It's different leagues around the world.
Okay, so but it's a straight up qualification. It's not one of those things where there's this committee sitting around going, well, these people qualified, but then we have to whittle it down to these people. Okay.
Certain qualifications that you have to meet to even get into the
you get points points for placings.
Okay, so it's an objective qualification versus a subjective qualification versus the Olympic Games, for example. It's very subjective. You have to qualify to be on the team, but then all those people who qualify are whittled down to X number by a committee who takes in lots of other subjective things. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a squad of eight horses, Grand Prix dressage horses, who will go to Europe. I think in May, end of May.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll compete to decide who is going to be on the team for Paris.
Got it. I just had a brilliant idea. Tigger, you need to go to Paris to the Olympics so that you can do your show from there. I decided that's going to be your next. And if you want Tigger to go to the Olympics so she can be our reporter on the ground for Healthy Critters Radio and other shows, please write to me, Jennifer@horseradionetwork.com, and put in your vote today. Just putting that out there into the universe.
Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
I think. One of the things that struck me, and this was after I watched it, was that I went to Dressage News, and a lot of the scores were way lower than what the riders had previously.
So the judging was really tough?
You know, they had judges, they had six judges.
Mm-hmm.
So they had three on each long side and two short side and two on each long side. That's a lot. That's a lot of judges. Eight judges.
Wow.
Wait a minute. One, two, three, four, five, seven.
Seven judges. Okay. Yeah, they can't have so one in A.
They normally don't have any judges sitting down in the on the short side at A. You have them at E and B, and then on the short side at C. So that's mm-hmm. five, but they added the other two corners.
Interesting.
In the short side by A. Yeah, which gives you a different perspective for sure.
Well, and that's important in dressage because there are only certain aspects of any given movement that you can actually see from where you're at. If the horse is moving directly Correct. Away from you, you can't see what's going on the front end. You just can't see it. Interesting.
Yeah. Oh.
Now, is this something that they're going to continue to do going forward, these extra judges, or is it something they just did for this one? Or?
I don't know. I found that, you know, fascinating.
Yeah.
Lottie Fry is in the lead. Patrick Cattell is second. Can't remember who's third. Isabel's fourth. The Americans are last and 11th and 12th, I think. So, you know,
there's nowhere to go but up.
Exactly. Exactly. So,
Wow. Well, that's fascinating. Cool.
What was really interesting, it kind of reminded me of Omaha, is that there's hardly a crowd.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Omaha was very disappointing to me. I didn't go, but seeing it on the live stream. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem with these venues of being big, like you can seat a lot of people, is that you lose the intimacy of dressage.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being at Sertogenbosch for the World Cup in 1997. It's a very small indoor venue, and people are packed in like sardines. And mm-hmm. it's great because you're so close to the horses.
Yeah, yeah. And I was talking about this to a show I just did the other day. Don't remember which show it was. But it should, and in America, we don't get to experience this very often. Perhaps a little bit if you're in some of the Western disciplines. But I think every horse person should have on their bucket list to go to a truly international level competition that garners tens of thousands of spectators. And then buy a ticket to sit in the stands and partake, regardless of what discipline it is, because it's a completely different experience when you have not 500 spectators, not 1,000 spectators, tens of thousands of spectators, completely different experience. And I would not have thought of that until I experienced it myself. And I went, this is a whole different kind of horse show, completely different. And there aren't a lot of venues or competitions in the United States that you can do that. So if you ever get the opportunity to attend one in the United States or elsewhere, regardless of the discipline, even if it's a discipline that's a little bit outside what you participate in, take a serious look at putting that on your bucket list, because it's one of those goosebump things, goosebump moments you will never forget.
Go to the Calgary Stampede.
That is on Glenn and I's bucket list and has been for many a year.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. I want to also go to Spruce Meadows sometime.
Oh, my God. It's a phenomenal. It's a show unlike any other.
I want to see Spruce Meadows. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done that twice.
Is there a venue or competition that is on your bucket list, Patty?
I'd love to go to Aachen.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to go to Aachen.
I've been to Aachen.
Is it worth the price? Ticket price?
Yeah. Yep.
There we go. You know, and if you've got a bucket list competition or venue, because for me, Spruce Meadows is the venue. I don't care what show's going on. I just want to go see it. If you've got one of those on your bucket list, drop me an email, jennifer@horseradionetwork.com. And if we think it's pretty cool too, we'll chat about it on the show and maybe have you chat about it too.
So our roundtable today is on maintaining habitat for songbirds and wild birds. And I know Jennifer's going to ask, how did you come up with this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I came up with it because we added another feeder to our feeder collection. So we're up to 9 feeders.
Wow.
And
wow.
Yeah. And so I take great interest in bird watching, who's coming to the feeder and who's fighting over the feeders and who likes to eat what, because we have different foods for the feeders, of course. Mm. And it made me ask myself, I wonder if any of these songbirds are endangered. Oh. So I went down that rabbit hole. Here's the bottom line. It's estimated that cats kill 4 billion birds a year.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, the other part of the die-off of migratory birds and songbirds and wild birds is habitat. So there were, I found a couple of very good articles about making habitats in your backyard and on your farm. So we started doing this maybe 7 or 8 years ago. It was for the pollinators, but now I see that it's benefiting the songbirds. So I'm very happy about that. When we mow our pastures, we leave a strip around the edge that we do not mow. And it just coincides with being the line of the forest. So a lot of birds really need forest covering. They need trees, they need bushes, they need grasses to get insects. So not mowing your entire pasture and leaving these sort of natural strips along the edges can really help the bird population. So it's important in your backyard to leave no-mow areas. And what we have done is ingratiated the no-mow areas with wildflowers. So it's no-mow, but it's pretty.
Well, see, that's a happy compromise.
Yes.
Because in some parts of the universe, you're not allowed to have non-mowed areas. And for other people, it's just like, right, they just can't stand the sight of overgrown and wildness. But by planting native wildflowers or non-invasive wildflowers, then it's technically garden so that your HOA can't complain. But it also gives benefit to the wildlife in the area, because when you get those mixes, you can get them so that they have a variety of heights in them.
Yeah.
Because they need that, like you said, they need that cover for them to live naturally. Even if there aren't predators out there, they still need that cover. That's how they're going to want to eat. That's very interesting to do it that way with our little itty bitty 5 acres that we have, that we hopefully, knock on wood, we'll be able to move into soon. What we did is it's 5 acres, but we wanted to leave as many trees as we could, but still have enough grazing area for the horses. So rather than just leave a tree here and leave a tree there, when they cleared the lot, because it was completely brush, you couldn't see the ground anywhere, we had them leave all the big mature trees. But instead of just cleaning out around them, each big mature tree has probably 20 or 30 square feet around it that is completely untouched. He left all the underbrush there, didn't touch it at all. And then if there were a couple of mature trees that were close together, we end up with rather a large contiguous area of untouched, so that once we finally get moved in there, we're not going to ever cut that. It's just going to be whatever it is. It has been there for 30 years. so that the wildlife in the area have at least some of that left. Because, you know, we don't want to just have, and we also like the way it looks. We kind of like that kind of wild and woolly, what's growing in there? I don't know. kind of thing. But that's interesting that, yeah, you have to, I like that you left it around the edge. They kind of have a transition. They have a genuinely wild area that's outside your property line, and then kind of a transition area before it gets to what's maintained.
Correct.
Yeah.
But the forest is part of our land. So it's kind of a natural fencing, even though we have fencing.
Now, what with your feeders for your birds, do you have anti-squirrel devices on any of your feeders, or is it a free-for-all?
Some it's a free-for-all. Some we have anti-squirrel, which isn't all that successful.
It's hard to find an anti-squirrel device that's really effective. They're geniuses, those little guys.
They are amazing.
They are geniuses. Yes, yes. We're not sure how we're going to deal with the bird feeder thing. I love to watch me some birds at a bird feeder, but I think we're going to live up there for a year or so before we get real hot and heavy in there so I can see what kind of birds we have and what kind of natural as well as imported predators we have up there, because I don't want to feed the predators. I want to feed the bird.
Well, what kind of predators would you be worried about?
Well, we definitely have fox because we've seen them trotting through.
You won't worry. You won't have to worry about bird feed with fox.
Well,
we have lots of foxes.
They don't bother. Well, I'm not worried about them eating the bird seed. I'm worried about them eating the birds that are feeding on the bird feeder.
we've not had a problem.
Really? So we don't have to worry about foxes.
Raccoons do like bird seed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So do skunks. So you do need, they don't climb up and get it. I mean, a raccoon could, but ours just
they're not motivated.
To open the sealed container where all the bird seed is. but they don't climb up the poles or even the tree to get it.
Good to know.
One thing that I learned, this article is from Birds and Blooms. It's very good to have some decomposing wood.
Oh, interesting.
We have plenty of that in Florida.
but the insects and the fungi are really helpful for the wild birds.
Well, we have lots of woodpeckers too.
Which is great.
Yeah, because we have insects aplenty here. But we were very happy the last couple of times we've gone up to the property to spot a couple of the woodpeckers. We've seen one of the big pileated guys up there. I don't know who was the guy.
Oh, the pileated, yeah.
Yeah, we saw one of those. And we've seen several times the medium-sized one, but not the one with the pretty gold on their chest. It's the other medium-sized one. We've seen a couple of those flitting about. So we have some of those. I just love woodpeckers. They're just really, really cool. One of my faves.
Me too. That's why I have so many suet feeders. another tip I learned from Birds and Blooms is the benefits on fences of vines.
Okay, explain that to me. What do they do?
Bees, butterflies, and insects enjoy the flowers of a vine and its welcome cover, and birds will enjoy eating the fruit and nesting in the denser foliage.
That's interesting.
Clematis, roses, honeysuckle provide a better refuge and home for wildlife than a plain fence.
Interesting. Well, we can't grow honeysuckle down here.
Oh.
Interesting.
But we do. I'm thinking, what do we have? Trumpet vines grow down here, but I'm not going to plant any of those because I think they're invasive in Florida. So we have to be really careful what we grow down here because of the invasive problem, because sometimes they thrive too much.
What zone are you in?
9.
Okay, so I'm looking that up. Mandevilla?
Not familiar with that one.
It's a drought-tolerant hummingbird vine.
Oh,
can
interesting.
Be grown in a container, hanging basket, or right in the garden.
Well, send me that one.
And the other one is a cup and saucer vine.
Yeah, I think those are bad for ponies, if memory serves.
Oh, okay.
See, and one of the things that we're doing with the property, the goal is that basically there will be a fence around the house. So it sort of has a perimeter fence around the house because the property's perimeter fence is fenced. But the horses are going to have pretty much the run of the place, except for around the house. So that they, if they decide to crawl through the brush and underbrush and crap that we've left for the wildlife, they're welcome to do that. So I'm trying to be careful not to put anything in that if Nigel decides he needs to taste test it, he's going to be okay.
Yeah.
So we had to take all the cherry trees out. But
is figwort? It says it grows in zones 9 and 10.
Figwort? I don't even know what figwort is.
The flowers resemble snapdragons.
Oh, figwort. I got pictures of some character in Lord of the Rings. I spelled it wrong. There, figwort.
It also grows on a trellis.
Figwort.
Well, there you go. I'll send you this.
Yeah. Figwort. There we go. Patty, do you have anything to attract, protect, or encourage the birds at your place? Because you're in Texas, right?
Well, yep. I'm in northern Texas, and we have incredible. We've got tons of cardinals, and I'm so disappointed because I just don't have the hummingbirds that I had in Virginia. But we have the little nut hatches. But I have found, and I can't find it again, this one absolute squirrel-proof bird feeder, and it's the only one that's never been broken because I have a lot of squirrels. And I'll put out like a mixed, you know, bird seed out and then it's for the cardinals. But I mean, that's it. I've been feverishly searching for that again. Every year I put something out for hummingbirds and I get one. I like plant for hummingbirds and I get one, and I'll see them maybe twice like through the summer. And like the last 2 years here over the summer had been pretty intense. So I always try to keep water out for them as well, but that's kind of, it's similar in some ways of Virginia, but then the last two summers have been so completely different, just because it's been so ungodly hot. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen this year.
Yeah. Well, that's a really important point, is having for the birds to have access to water where they can either take a bath or drink. That's as important to the backyard as the food is and the habitat.
There you go. And if you're concerned about the water becoming stagnant in your watering device, whether it's a fancy bird bath or just a shallow pail or something, you can get for just about nothing on Amazon little teeny tiny solar powered fountains that are made for bird baths. And what my mom did on her back porch where she put hers is she just had, you know, those, it's a plastic planter, but it looks like it made out of plastic, but it looks like an old whiskey barrel. She had something about that size. And she just put it out there and put water in it. And she just put one of those in it. And that kept the water moving around. She dropped a goldfish in there. And it worked fabulous for her. Yeah.
Cool. That is such a cool idea.
Yeah. And she just literally, you know, the 25-cent feeder goldfish that you get at the pet store. You get yourself a handful of those because one of them always dies. And she just dropped them in there. There was a couple of rocks in the bottom of it. And she'd prop by keeping the water moving, you shouldn't have to have any kind of filtration for the goldfish. It should all work itself out. But, you know, I see that gives me an idea. Now I might have to do that, am I, at our house too. But anyhow, thank you very much for all these clever, helpful hints for songbirds
and
other
birds. Take care of our birds.
Yeah, take care of our birds.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if you have clever ideas about songbirds or other wild birds at your place, let us know. We'd love to hear about it. Greetings, Hedwig!
Hello.
Eddie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. 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 When Otis, your alter ego, Otis, the podcasting warm blood, was on, I had a few people reach out to me and ask where you were. They were worried you were gone.
No, I was being held hostage in a closet.
In a closet?
Stupid Otis was talking.
Really? Yes, and Otis did a very good job.
Yes, he did.
He did. We Otis, appreciated his input.
Otis tried hard.
Hi, Otis. How are you?
Oh, no. Otis is being shut.
Shut. You jerk! I will not have this usurpation of my role.
Well, Otis, it is Hedwig's turn this week.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Bye, Otis.
I'm scared now.
I don't blame you. I'd be scared too if I was in the same room as Hedwig.
Too.
Well, Otis is going away.
Bye, Otis.
Bye, Otis.
Bye.
Okay, Hedwig, I have an important question for you.
What?
Sleeping arrangements. Mm-hmm. Not, I want to know specifically for Hedwig, the world's only podcasting Pomeranian. What are acceptable or non-acceptable sleeping arrangements for Hedwig, the world's only podcasting Pomeranian?
I like to sleep on a bed next to my sister. Unless it's cold, and then I like to sleep on a bed with my sister.
So, expand upon with your sister versus next to your sister.
Well, we have beds, you know, there are probably 15 or so in the home. And we like to choose where we're going to sleep at any given point in time. For example, during the day, we sleep in what is known as laughably an office, because of course the human has no job, so it's not like she's employable. But theoretically, I suppose she might be. And so she has this space in which she claims to work. And in this space, there are dog beds. And we like to sit on those dog beds. And sometimes we sit each of us on one. And sometimes I like to snuggle up with my sister.
I understand now. So sometimes you share the same dog bed.
Yes.
Sometimes you have your very own dog bed. Now, do you like to have your special beds that nobody else is allowed to sleep on? Or do you share equally?
Well, I get whatever bed I want. Unless my sister is on the bed before me and doesn't want to share.
I see. So it's first come, first served. Whoever gets there first.
Me or my sister. Everybody else has to move for us.
I see. So you two are co-royalty of the home.
Well, my sister is known as the Pope, but people get offended by that.
I see no reason why there shouldn't be a female Pope. I think it's perfectly fine.
I don't either.
It's more on this rock I will build my church, but whatever.
Well, thank you very much for sharing with us, Hedwig, your preferences as far as sleeping conditions at the home. And let your servant know that we appreciate her giving us the time to talk to you.
I'll speak and with her.
Give the carrot to Otis for me.
I will let him out of his permanently locked stall later.
Bye-bye, Hedwig.
Bye, Hedy.
And now it's time for the breed of the show.
So we are doing the Cardigan Welsh Corgi, which has been brought to my attention. It's the only animal named after a sweater.
Absolutely.
And not actually thought of that. They're a very well-known dog that you can see around barn dogs or around horses or even found on ranches. They're a very small, tenacious little herding breed. They are first and foremost herding dogs with a wonderful, energetic personality. And they're often great family dogs. Tigger, have you ever had a corgi? I know you had crosses of corgis.
I had two corgis. I had Kizzy and Toby.
Okay, I don't think I've met them, but that's the one dog I haven't had. Well, I haven't had several dogs, but you know, I still have time. But
do you mean several 5 or 6 or several 10 or 20?
5 or 6.
Yeah.
But they're known to be great family dogs, and they can be gentle and patient with kids. But a couple things to consider. They're tiny. They're a smaller dog, but they do need exercise. And if you don't give them the exercise, they will find something to herd. That's why I mentioned the herding part in the beginning. They will herd small children if they don't get that exercise. They're also quite talkative, or as others would say, yappy and barky, because they're a herding dog. So this is kind of interesting. One of the things that I read, and I'll be interesting, Tigger, to know if this was your experience. Because they're a small dog and they have a longer back, they're not recommended for two-story homes because of them going up and down the stairs. Did you have any trouble with yours and their backs?
As they got older.
Okay. Well, then that's something to definitely consider. They're very intelligent, alert, and devoted, and active, as I've mentioned. They're good with other animals when produced properly. I did see, probably more than any other dog that I've researched, a bunch of different several websites on how you can train your corgi. So that would be something I would definitely suggest looking at before you would get one. Their lifespan is 12 to 15 years. Again, make sure you know what you're getting, because they are a tiny little tenacious thing. They come in a bunch of different colors. They come in a merle, a brindle with a white, a blue merle with a white, sable with a white, just to name a few. There's a whole bunch of other ones out there. Females and males both get anywhere from 10 to 13 inches. But amazingly, they can weigh up to 30 pounds, which I just think is so funny. I'm just like, wow. Health problems to watch out for. They can have joint issues, heart disease, and obviously back pain. So these are all things to consider before you would actually purchase them. So lastly, this is kind of interesting because, of course, everybody hears of corgi, and being in the horse world, as we all are, you know, we think corgi, and then you hear that there's the Cardigan, and then you'll hear that there's the Pembroke. So I wanted to find out a couple differences between the two. The Pembroke is known for having a shorter bob tail. The Welsh Corgi is kept longer and sort of more fox-like. Apparently, their eyes are slightly different. But the easiest way to tell them apart is that the Cardigan tends to have bigger ears. I did not know that.
Significantly bigger. And they have a tail.
Yeah, right, like a fox-like tail.
Which the Pembroke doesn't have at all.
Correct. Yeah. So I just found all of that to be incredibly interesting. It's the one dog that I've never had. Wasn't Jar Jar crossed? Because you'll see, I don't know if you guys have found this, but I feel like every time if you go to Florida and you're in like public barn places, there's always corgi crosses of some sort. Whether they're intentional and not intentional. And I'm beginning to see that they're making more. There's like an Aussie corgi cross.
I know. Can you believe that?
I mean, talk about insane. Like, that must be a dog that that's not a dog that I would want between. Because again, I mean, corgis are wonderful dogs, but they're yappy. They're yappy, and they're always moving and herding things, you know, along. But, and they're great little dogs, and they're fantastic companions, and they're easy to get in and out of a car, except if you know, they're up to 30 pounds. But but they truly are. They're a great dog for family. They're great with children, and they're wonderful with other pets as long as they're exercised properly and introduced properly. But they're
very bossy. Corgis are very bossy. And not in a mean way, just in a small dog. Kind of a Napoleon complex.
Yeah. But they're much I always considered Australian Shepherds and Corgis to be somewhat similar in their herding and whatever. But doing this research, I realized that they're really not.
No, they're different. They're very different in their herding and their drive.
Yes. Wouldn't you say the Corgi's drive is a little bit more intense?
Well, I wouldn't say it's intense. I just say they're like busybodies.
Oh, that's a good way to. Okay. Yeah. A little bit more nosy, sort of like always telling people what to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's going on here? And I got to inspect this. Yep. And
you should be doing this. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a good thing to note. Any of the listeners that are considering a corgi, realize that you better. Well, I mean, the queen has them, so, but that's a Pembroke, right?
Yes, that's what I had was a Pembroke. I did not have a cardigan.
Yeah,
my two were Pembrokes.
Well, anyway, yeah, I think they're fabulous little dogs. Not one I've had, but would recommend doing research before I get one, and that's easy to do when you look on the internet.
Real horses and real dogs are healthier, perform better, and recover more quickly on real food. That's why BioStar empowers horse and canine owners with 100% whole food nutrition, supplements, and feeding programs. BioStar products are made at their own certified non-GMO facility in Gordonsville, Virginia, using real food ingredients that are raw, freeze-dried, or dehydrated, never cooked, and are free from artificial flavors, colors, soy, corn, wheat, and molasses. The BioStar product line includes a wide range of whole food, horse and dog supplements, treats, and unique artisan poultices that embrace the ancient and traditional uses of clay and plants. Visit BioStarUS.com today and learn about whole foods and canine and equine nutrition so you can make the best decisions about the care and health of your horses and dogs. That's BioStarUS.com. Whole food nutrition the way nature intended.
And now we're at Critter Nutrition, and the focus is on S. boulardii, which is a probiotic for dogs. The yeast strain Saccharomyces boulardii is one of the most researched probiotic strains on the planet, and it's become very popular for dogs. It is known for its benefits in managing GI tract issues, dysbiosis, and diarrhea. It is beneficial for IBS and dental issues like periodontal disease and gingivitis. S. boulardii provides immune support and can provide a level of steric hindrance to mucosa invasion by pathogens including Clostridium and E. coli. S. boulardii is considered one of the best probiotics for colonizing gut microbe populations, particularly during and after antibiotic therapy. Because it is a yeast strain, it remains unaffected by antibiotics, unlike bacterial strains such as Lactobacillus and Bifidus. S. boulardii can survive the harsh environment of the stomach, arriving intact and alive when it reaches the intestines. The Lactobacillus and Bifidus strains must be microencapsulated or enteric coated to pass safely through the stomach. Like other probiotic strains, S. boulardii produces short-chain fatty acids, which aid in maintaining integrity of the intestinal barrier. They support mucus production and provide protection from inflammation. New research shows that short-chain fatty acids from the microbiota of the GI tract also play an important role in the development and homeostasis of the central nervous system. Because of this communication between gut and brain, chronic stress can result in gut dysbiosis, diarrhea, and other GI tract disorders in dogs. Even short-term stress from travel, vet visits, new routine, change in the home environment, pharmaceutical therapies, and stress of the owner can also result in GI tract issues in dogs. In either case, S. boulardii provides essential probiotic support for dogs under stress. BioStar is releasing a new formula for dogs called Hedgerow boulardii on Earth Day, April 22nd. And hedgerow boulardii is a combination of plants commonly found in the famous hedgerows in England with other gut support ingredients. From the hedgerow, we use chamomile to reduce anxiety and indigestion and help support the regulation of the GI tract's inflammatory response. We added nettle. It's a green herb that provides fiber and chlorophyll to support a healthy GI tract. The additional GI support includes lion mane mushrooms because of the polysaccharides that promote the growth of beneficial bacteria in the gut. Of course, lion mane has been used in Chinese medicine for thousands of years for intestinal mucosa protection against bouts of gastritis and IBS. It is considered gastroprotective. We include fermented turmeric. Like other fermented foods, this can help strengthen intestinal walls and prevent leaking. Fermented foods are also a source of friendly bacteria. So consumption of fermented foods increases diversity of the microbiome. Studies have shown that fermented turmeric has a higher curcumin content compared to unfermented turmeric. We added pumpkin meal because it's a great source of soluble fiber to support the large intestine. We added one of the soil-based organisms, Bacillus subtilis. It's a spore-forming bacteria that can survive the harsh environment of the stomach to colonize the intestines. This soil-based organism can protect the intestinal epithelium against pathogens, including Salmonella and E. coli. Lastly, we added my favorite, eggshell membrane collagen, because it's important for the integrity of the intestinal walls. Eggshell membrane collagen provides specific amino acids such as glycine, glutamine, and proline to facilitate repair of the gut lining, allowing it to provide support for conditions like inflammatory bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome in dogs. With 6 billion CFUs of S. boulardii per serving, hedgerow boulardii is a unique supplement because it not only addresses the need for probiotic colonization in the dog's GI tract, it also addresses the stress component that frequently imbalances the bacterial colonies. It's an excellent support tool for overall maintenance of a healthy GI tract.
And here we are at Coffee Clatch. I'm not having coffee at Coffee Clatch this evening. I think I might have a glass of wine at Coffee Clatch.
There you go. We should have it, call it Wine Clatch.
Maybe we should. Yeah. We're missing out on this thing. Coffee Clatch this time is all about fly control because it's fast getting to be that time of year that all equestrians roll their eyeballs and all that sort of thing. So Tigger, again, I will ask, what inspired this topic?
A fly got in the house.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Can you imagine back in the day growing up, a fly in the house, nobody ever noticed a fly in the house. But these days with everybody has air conditioning, the windows are closed, all that. One fly gets in the house and you feel like it's the end of the world.
It's annoying.
Oh, it's so annoying.
Oh my God.
It only takes one.
It only takes one.
So what is your favorite fly control, Tigger?
Oh, fly predators.
Oh, you stole my thunder.
Me too.
So what do you love about them?
Well, my neighbor also uses them.
Oh, that makes a big difference. Yeah.
It makes a huge difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long have you been using fly predators?
Say 8 or 9 years.
8 or 9 years. Now, when you started using them, did you just order a bunch up and have at it, or did you do a consult?
No, I just ordered a bunch.
Just ordered a bunch and had at it. All right. Yep. So, Patty, how about you?
Oh, I've been using fly predators since Farfield Tigs. I've been using them, oh gosh, how many years is
20 that? 20 years.
20 years?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And I like them because they're non-invasive. I mean, there is one other thing that I had to do last year because the flies literally were going, there were so many flies last year and all of them decided at night to be in my house. Like anywhere they were in the country, they ended up in my house at night.
The email went out.
Yep. Yeah, like if you were like, geez, where'd my flies go? Oh, they're at Patty's. But the one other thing that I did do, because I had to do something more aggressive, was it's called fly bait, and you put them in these little contraptions, and that really did help cut down the amount of flies. Didn't completely get rid of them, but between that and the fly predators, that was very helpful.
Interesting.
I still use the strips too. The icky fly strips.
The sticky ones that are coming in a little tube.
Yep.
Yeah. You know what I like about those? They only catch the flies where they're at.
Yes.
Because there's no, you can get them with no attractant. So it's just the flies that are hanging out where you hang them. Ooh, there you go. Hope you're okay out there. So do you use stuff other than you use your fly bait and you use your fly predators? Do you use just whatever kind of fly spray for the horses physically?
I use Esprit.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just essential oils.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was with Patty that we discovered the wonders of apple cider vinegar.
Absolutely.
Fly repellent. That's pretty good. Even if your horse does smell like an Italian restaurant afterwards.
Yeah.
But I also learned about putting lime on the manure.
Back in the day, we didn't, before the invention of the rubber stall mat, there, there were times when horses stood on a dirt floor in a barn.
Yes, they did.
They did. Or the very first barn my horses ever lived in had a wood floor.
Wow. Now that's like New England.
Yeah, that was big time, old time. But concrete floors, clay floors, wood floors, they were all out there. And you would have a little bucket of hydrated lime and you'd sprinkle it on the moist parts of the floor.
Yep.
And it was extremely effective at keeping the flies to a minimum because the gases that are given off by the dirty floor
are soaked up by the lime.
They're
neutralized.
They're neutralized by the lime, and therefore the flies don't go, oh, I want to go here. It doesn't smell good to them anymore. It doesn't smell like cinnamon buns to them.
No. No.
So, that was it. And something that people don't, and I had a really interesting conversation. This is so funny that it was today's question, because I just talked to the folks at Fly Predators last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did a couple of tips for Horse Tip Daily with them because I wanted to learn about it. And I learned all about how fly predators work, what kind of flies they work on, how to create an effective fly control program for the whole farm versus just one part of the farm, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to hear that, go over to Horse Tip Daily, and just probably if you could type in the word fly predator in the search button, you'll find it. But I didn't realize that different species of flies have to have different types of fly control.
Predators,
the fly predators are very specific about which type of fly pupa they lay their eggs in, which is why the pupa never hatches, which is one of the reasons, of course, that they're so safe and effective, is they're very specific. They're not going to bother bees. They're not going to bother other pollinators. They're not going to bother butterflies. It's only these couple of very specific nuisance flies that bother our horses. But she had all sorts of great suggestions on those types of flies that a fly predator is not going to target. And since we have cattle adjacent to where our horses live, we have horn flies, which are the ones that land on their eyeballs.
Oh, God.
Is it the eyeball one? I think it's the back one. I think it's the one that lands on their back. But it's also the one that when they go in the shade, the fly leaves. It doesn't like shade. Oh. So if the horse is standing in the shade, it won't land on them. There we go. But she had suggestions on how to deal with the horn flies. So if you are interested in fly predators, not a paid commercial, by the way, it should be, but it's not, talk to them. They'll help you out. But that's very interesting to use the lime and the vinegar. Now, you just spray the vinegar on horses?
Yes.
Just like fly the same way you would fly
a rinse.
Oh, like a rinse. Interesting.
Yep.
I wonder what it is about rinsing them with vinegar that makes them unappealing to the fly.
The smell.
Because it just smells like vinegar?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's offensive, kind of like the smell of cheap perfume to a human.
Yes. Yeah. One thing I have noticed is when we bought this farm 40 years ago, most of or a lot of the tree lines had cedars.
Mm-hmm.
And the horses in the summer go and rub themselves up against the cedars and get that oil on their skin, which is a natural fly repellent.
Huh.
So having some cedars that the horses can access is helpful. And one year I decided to do praying mantises.
You just went on Amazon and ordered them?
No, I had to go to a praying mantis hatchery.
Really?
Yeah.
Didn't know there was one of those.
Well, they send it to you in their little cocoony thing.
Oh, you
it hasn't hatched
home.
Yet. Yeah, oh, you hatch them at home.
Okay.
And I love praying mantises because they eat their mates.
Of course you do.
Female eats the mate. I think that's brilliant.
Hedwig may have been a praying mantis in a former life.
Maybe. I just think they're fascinating, you know, like creatures from another planet. And they're very good fly killers. Unfortunately, you know, certain birds and things also like praying mantises.
Yeah,
so
there we go.
That was Circle not as successful, but they're cool to have around.
Circle of life. There we go. Mm. Interesting. So there's that part.
Yeah. Now,
for your dogs, other than obvious, you know, flea and tick control for your dogs, do you have to do anything for them? Do they get bothered by the flies at all?
No.
No?
They're double coated.
Because they have the thick, heavy coats. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know with the greyhounds, they're the thoroughbred of the dog world. If one fly lands on them, it's the end of the universe.
Oh, jeez.
The end of the universe. It's just incredible, the panic that sets in.
Hmm.
Interesting. Now,
yeah, we don't have that problem.
Patty, with do your chickens help with the fly population at all, do you think? Or that is there to look at?
I'm not really sure if they do.
Ticks.
And I know they help with ticks, yeah.
Chickens are good with ticks.
I'm not sure that they do anything with the flies. I'm going to have to really pay attention to that this summer, actually.
Yeah, there we go.
I don't notice that mine go after flies much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have lots of lizards here. They go after the flies.
Yeah, lizards are great.
And we got lots of lizards, so yay us.
Mm.
Yeah, Kenobi spent the entire winter chasing lizards. He thought that was immensely fun.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. One final comment on our favorite fly control. And I got this little tidbit from the lady over at Fly Predators. And I never thought about this. Many of us have our manure. We put it into a skip, a dumpster of some sort, which is periodically emptied by a company. Mm. And a lot of people will get fly predators and they don't want to put it in the dumpster because it gets taken away every month, but right. And she was talking to a client who had fly predators and they were struggling because it didn't seem to be as working as well as they thought it should. And he said, is that because the dumpster gets taken out every month? So she went and they will actually visit your farm. She went out and visited the farm and I never thought about this. It wasn't the dumpster that was the problem. It was those little bits and bobs that land outside the dumpster. And then you have this thin layer of slurry underneath and around where the dumpster goes.
Wow.
What?
Yes, that's where the breeding was happening. And she said, don't put it in the dumpster. Put it around the dumpster where all that is. Or alternately, if you're not using fly predators, clean up every scrap. And if possible, keep your dumpster on some kind of hard pack or concrete.
Interesting.
Yeah, in Virginia, we don't have dumpsters.
Yeah. She said, even if you have a mower and you don't clean the the grass that builds up on the top of the mower when you're mowing, you get that thick layer of dried grass on top and underneath, breeding ground for flies. Did not
know. Interesting. Wow.
Yes. Breeding ground for flies. So clean all that stuff off the top and bottom of your mower. The mower will last longer and you'll have fewer flies. That's your PSA for the day.
That's huge.
Yeah. That is huge.
Yeah, but you know, there we go. Interesting stuff today, ladies.
I agree.
Dun, dun, dun. So if you want to hear more of this kind of stuff, we'd love to hear your ideas. Drop us a line. You can write to Tigger over at BioStar US. You can write to me, Jennifer, horseradionetwork.com. Toss us some ideas. We want to hear them.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and thanks to our sponsor, BioStar US. You can find them online at BioStarUS.com.